Next, in number 2011-1507, Day Pharma against Sunovion Pharma. Let's wait just a second, Mr. Bittman, until everybody gets ready to go here. All set? Very well.
May it please the court. This appeal is about a generic company who filed late with the FDA, is unhappy about the results of its delay, and is now burdening the courts and Sunovion with speculative litigation for the sole purpose...
Oh, that's not necessary. This is a serious case. It's not,
yes, Your Honor.
You know, address the merits of it rather than just sort of try to dismiss it.
Well, there are two reasons why jurisdiction is lacking in this appeal, which I'd like to discuss. First, Day's alleged harm is not concrete or imminent. Day seeks a declaratory judgment that would have no real-world effect. And second, to trigger a potential forfeiture event, Day has to obtain a final judgment of either non-infringement or invalidity.
Let's suppose the date at which BREP could go to market were 2 years from now, or 3 years from now, okay? Would there be declaratory judgment jurisdiction then?
If BREP could go to market 2 to 3 years from now, but there were still patents that were being asserted by Sunovion against Day in litigation that would expire after that date, the request for a declaratory judgment would still be speculative. Because again, these later expiring Orange Book patents would be blocking.
You mean if the challenges are divided between two cases that it can never be declaratory judgment in jurisdiction in one of the cases?
Well, I submit that in order there to be jurisdiction, the declaratory judgment must address a harm that is real and concrete and imminent.
But it can't really be the case, can it, that you can argue that the harm is speculative in case number one if you don't already have relief in case number two, and it's speculative in case number two because you don't already have relief in case number one, right? I mean, aren't you allowed to proceed sequentially to knock out various barriers to the relief you ultimately seek, even if there's more than one barrier and requires more than one lawsuit?
But I think the point is that there is jurisdiction by virtue of the patentee asserting these later expiring Orange Book patents, as I'll refer to them. And because there's jurisdiction in that particular case, the barrier, which is again the 180 days, which requires all the patents to be found invalid or not infringed, that's currently being handled in this first litigation where there is jurisdiction. And until you get to the point where there is a final judgment on those patents, then a declaratory judgment has no effect.
Well, but if there, let's suppose that BREP decides not to launch at the earliest possible launch date, based perhaps on its agreement with Sunovion. Now, the question of how long it takes to resolve the underlying contested litigation ceases to be particularly important, right? That will get resolved. And if it gets resolved in favor of Day, then Day's declaratory judgment, success on the declaratory judgment matters a lot, does it not? It keeps it from having to wait until 2021, if I understand it, if BREP decides to wait until then to launch.
Well, first thing I'd like to address is Day actually makes the argument that perhaps BREP could delay.
Right.
But and there's really no basis, first of all, on the record to make that
well,
argument.
Well, except for my question, that the basis in the record for that is the agreement between Sunovion and BREP, that this gives BREP at least an arguable incentive to do something other than what a normal rational actor would do in the absence of such an agreement, which is launch as soon as it could. So this gives BREP an alternative way to make money without launching its generic product. So assume that is a sufficient ground to provide at least a rational likelihood that there will be a delay. Now, with that background, why isn't this declaratory judgment request for relief material to the injury that Day contends it's suffering?
First thing I'd like to point out is that under this court's case law, including Carrico and Janssen, that the focus of the jurisdictional injury is between now and when the first filer is able to launch. And again, unless there's a basis of the record.
Not quite. I mean, what our cases have said, that if the only injury at the start of the suit is the possible injury as a result of the delay, that that's not sufficient for jurisdiction. But there's a difference between starting jurisdiction in the first place and mootness. Under TEVA, this case would become moot if there was a launch and the 180-day period started to run. But as Judge Bryson points out, we don't know whether that's going to happen. It hasn't happened yet. So why can't this case, since there was declaratory judgment jurisdiction in the first place, continue until it becomes moot?
Because there can't be jurisdiction in the first place without a concrete harm. And again here, this is unlike this court's decision in Carrico, where there was an actual delay, that no matter what happened with respect to the other challenge involving the asserted Orange patent, the 712 patent, no matter what happened with respect to that challenge, it was guaranteed that there would be an early entry date for the subsequent filing.
You seem to be arguing that because there are two suits pending, each one can be a ground for saying that the other one lacks jurisdiction.
Well, to be clear, the first suit, there is jurisdiction by the assertion of patents by the patent.
Well, suppose we had a situation in which the patents were divided between two declaratory judgment cases, right? And you'd be arguing, oh, well, in case one, you can't get any relief because case two would be a barrier. In case two, you'd be arguing the opposite. That doesn't seem right.
Well, certainly that's not this case. There isn't two declaratory judgments. There's an actual litigation. And it's litigation in which, as Sonovian recently informed the court, they has been found to willfully infringe five patents, including two patents that will expire in 2013.
But analytically, in thinking about the problem of whether there is a non-speculative injury, if you could take Judge Dyke's example, wouldn't you think that in that situation the injury in each of the two cases would be non-speculative?
In a case where it were purely just two separate declaratory judgment actions, which I would wonder why a subsequent filer would do that in the first place, but if they did, certainly there would have to be jurisdiction in one of the cases. But in that case, it's interesting because in order for there to be this sort of declaratory judgment hypothetical, you'd be talking about a situation where there's a covenant not to sue granted. So in that scenario, it would have to be a covenant across the board, in which case there isn't really much to litigate. Unlike this case, where Sonovian has asserted five patents, and the parties are actually litigating those patents.
But why should we say that there's priority to the infringement suit, and that it has to be resolved before you can bring a declaratory judgment suit? Why shouldn't they both proceed at the same time?
Because Article 3 requires that there be an actual concrete harm to be able to seek a declaratory judgment.
But actual concrete harm is this declaratory judgment action is attacking a patent which has to be invalidated or found not infringing in order to trigger the 180-day exclusivity period.
But again, that judgment would be meaningless. It's an abstract judgment unless you have the other patents also subject to a judgment, which in this case, again, are expiring after the first filer is able to come into the market pursuant to a settlement agreement that was pro-competitive, enabled an earlier launch by 1 year. They've been now planning for about 4 years to come into the market.
Suppose we reject that argument. What other grounds are there for finding a lack of declaratory judgment jurisdiction?
Yes, Your Honor. The second ground for finding no jurisdiction in this appeal would be the practical inability of any judgment to have any real-world effect because, again, all the judgments have to happen by no later than June 6th in order to trigger a potential forfeiture event. And that's less than 3 months from today. Currently at the district court, we have a judgment.
Well, that might moot jurisdiction at some point in time, but would it really warrant affirming the denial, you know, affirming or going back and reversing the denial of the motion to dismiss? Because we have to look at whether jurisdiction existed as of the date the complaint was filed. And
yeah, you have to look at, of course, from the date the case was filed, but you also have to look at throughout all stages of review, including today on appeal. And this is similar to the way the court looked at this in the Merck versus Apotex case, which is non-precedential. And in that case, there hadn't been an actual first filer launch, but the court looked at the circumstances, and again, MedImmune says, look at all the circumstances. I submit this would be a circumstance, and said that we can't, from a practical perspective.
Do you think later arising facts are a circumstance? I mean, for example, in DJ jurisdiction, we've always rejected the idea that the patentee subsequently actually sues the alleged infringer on the patent. We've never been willing to look at that as a basis for creating DJ jurisdiction, but you think nonetheless we should look forward and see what happens in another suit and all these other things?
I think particularly when you're talking about here a real potential waste of resources, you know, these are complex jurisdictional issues, and here we're talking about they would have to complete the proceedings of the district court, which they currently haven't even filed their post-trial motion 23 days after the judgments were entered. We would have to complete the remaining proceedings of the district court, and then before June 6th, complete an entire appeal, including arguments, briefing, decision, any petitions for a hearing. It's completely impractical, and frankly...
Oh, we can expedite things.
Perhaps, but this case doesn't become moot until Brett goes on the market and triggers the 180-day period, right?
Certainly there is no mootness until that happens, but again, there's no basis in the record at all, not a single shred of evidence in the record to suggest that Brett will delay even one day when it's entitled to. And in fact, in the record, there's a press release that Brett appreciates the certainty and is ready to launch. This is a settlement agreement that happened.
Brett has two rights, and which is, of course, what raises the specter of its not launching. And it can distribute under the NDA rather than distributing under the ANDA, as I understand its options, correct?
Brett
could distribute Synovians, in effect, Synovians branded drug. Pursuant to a license from Synovia.
Yeah, Brett does have options. Brett is in the business of selling products to make money. And
right.
Again,
one of the options for selling products is to work directly with the branded drugs, which it is now has an option to do, correct?
Regardless of when Brett comes in the market, Brett's exclusivity will be triggered however they come in.
You're saying that even if they sell the branded product under the NDA, that the 180-day exclusivity period is triggered.
My understanding of the statute is that if the first filer sells product, that would be triggering
it. It doesn't have to be the generic product that was authorized by the ANDA. It can be reselling the NDA product. I that was not my understanding, but my understanding is based on a fairly thin record reading of the statute. So
my understanding is that when that generic comes in the market, it would trigger the potential forfeiture.
You don't mean not when the generic comes in the market. You mean whenever even if it's an authorized under the NDA and it comes on the market. You mean when that person who filed the ANDA and has the exclusivity comes on the market. Right?
My understanding is the FDA would look at is that this is the first filer is now entering the market and we've now giving them the exclusivity and that exclusivity begins to run.
This may be an issue of sufficient significance that I wonder if the parties would not mind providing us with a letter with authority both stating your position as to this question. You understand the question, obviously, that we're focusing on.
Yes, Your Honor.
Whether the distribution, not of the generic drug under the ANDA, but by the first filer, whether the distribution or something of drugs under the NDA would trigger, right? Okay.
We'll be happy to do that.
All right.
I see that I'm in my rebuttal time. I'd like to reserve whatever I have left.
Very good. We will save that.
Thank you.
Ms. Love, do you have a different answer to that question that we were just focusing on? And in any event, whether you have an answer right now or not, we would like an answer from you if you would. Perhaps both parties could give us that, and would 10 days be a reasonable
request? Absolutely.
Okay, thank you very much.
Do you have a view on it now?
Do I have a view on it now? I think that once the first filer, I don't have a precise view on it, but I know that the first filer can sell its exclusivity to another ANDA. So that would lead me to believe that that a first filer does not have to be selling its own product. But I really do not know, to be honest with you.
Why don't we then in 10 days... It can be in just letter form, very short. You don't need, like the exposition, just an answer and reference to legal materials that may be pertinent to the question. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Are there incentives here for Brett to delay entry?
are there incentives for Brett to delay entry? There could be. That is, the delay of entry is the whole reason that the MMA was enacted, because generic companies were making deals with brand companies to settle their litigation, and then they wouldn't go to market.
Isn't that why you're here? I mean, I had thought, perhaps I'm mistaken, but I had thought your concern, your real concern, was not that we want to cut down the time by a few days. Your concern is that if Brett doesn't go to market, you may be out of luck until 2021.
Isn't that your concern?
So if Brett, at any point between now and 2021, assuming this case goes away, if Brett ever markets, then it starts the time running, and you're good.
That's correct.
The earlier the better, as far as you're concerned.
That's correct.
So I would have thought that would be the central focus of your pragmatic concerns about this case, and isn't that really why you're here?
Well, my concern is that they won't go to market right away. And
that's
that
what I'm
saying. Yes, and that we will be kept out until...
And there's no forfeiture. The forfeiture provision doesn't apply here.
That's correct. The forfeiture provision would apply if...
Once there's an invalidity or non-infringement determination,
but not until
that.
That's right.
They can delay up until 2021.
Absolutely.
And a covenant not to sue is not the effective equivalent of a judgment of non-infringement.
That's right, Your Honor.
If Mr. Dittman were to offer you to substitute a judgment, a consent judgment of non-infringement today, you'd be thrilled.
Absolutely.
For the covenant not to sue.
Because then we couldn't be kept out of the market by the 289 patent, which we do not infringe.
Right. So help me to understand what the incentives would be to delay marketing after the date when they're entitled to do it under the settlement.
Well, the incentives could be some sort of a deal between Synovian and Breath. I don't know what other deals there were. I do know that there was some sort of a getting together on another drug was part of this. So I really don't know. There could be all sorts of reasons. What I would like to point out, though...
There hasn't been any discovery on this question.
There's been no discovery in this case at all, Your Honor, because it was a judgment on the pleadings.
All right.
What's important is that the whole reason that the 2003 amendments were put into the Hatch-Waxman Act was because there were these settlements.
So there could be some sort of side agreement that we don't even know about, which would give them incentives to lay down on the market.
That's right. We don't know.
Such as a cash payment.
Could be. And we wouldn't know about that. The point is that if you grant... The point is actually that we have jurisdiction now. Under the Carrico case, we had jurisdiction when we brought this in 2008. We had jurisdiction when Judge Stark signed the final order of non-infringement in 2011. And we have jurisdiction now, because we faced that harm all through those times. And that would be the only basis to dismiss us, would be to say that we didn't have jurisdiction at one of those times, not that we might not have it in the future.
Well, the basis for dismissing would be is if it becomes moot when they go to market.
Right.
And your opponent agrees that it's not moot until that happens.
That's correct. It's not moot until that happens, so we have jurisdiction until that happens.
Do all of the other patents expire before the 289?
Yes. Three of the patents have already expired, and the last patent expires in August 2013.
So even if I realize we received supplemental authority about the ongoing case involving the other patents, and if I understand that authority right, it was that the district court held valid and infringed. Is that right?
That was a jury verdict, Your Honor, and that is not a final judgment.
No, I get it. Okay. But I'm saying even if it is a final judgment, even if it comes through on appeal and we affirm it, your argument is we still need to get in on the 289 because it prolongs the entry time all the way until it expires.
That's right. If you
argument, right?
If you reverse the district court, and Brett doesn't go to market, and the 994 patent expires in August 2013, we would have to bring another judgment on the 289 patent to get a judgment on that so that we could trigger Brecht exclusivity. Now, this isn't a case where we're trying to get in before Brecht, certainly, as was in the Janssen case or the Merck case.
Are you sure? Not even, you might, because when you started this litigation, if litigation had moved incredibly expeditiously, you could have feasibly gotten in before Brecht, right? Because you could have invalidated the patent more than 180 days in advance of August 2012. Isn't that right?
Well, no.
If you had invalidated the patent very quickly, couldn't you have caused their 180 days to start when they weren't even able to enter because of the settlement agreement?
Well, I would disagree that they wouldn't be able to enter because of the settlement agreement. Because the settlement agreement...
Because if somebody else goes to market, they can.
They can go to market. So,
but there was
that safety issue.
If somebody else goes to market, they can, but wouldn't that have eliminated their 180 days?
I don't know what the agreement between...
Yeah, that would depend on the agreement.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
Okay.
I don't know what their agreement was.
I'm sorry. Let me move to, it's a related point, but there's language in both Janssen and Karaka that I want you to comment on. And it's summarized in the last couple of pages of Janssen, in which, citing footnote 14 of Karaka, the court says that possible delay of the first paragraph for end of filer launching after the expiration of a patent is too speculative to create a justiciable Article III case of controversy. You're familiar with that.
Yes, I am familiar.
Can you comment on that and why that isn't a sufficient ground to deny relief to you in this case?
It's not sufficient for several reasons. The first reason is that, again, we have jurisdiction. We still have jurisdiction.
You say on the theory that this whole thing could get wrapped up in the next few weeks and so forth, but
no, not on the theory that it could get wrapped up in the first.
But there was jurisdiction initially when it was first filed.
Correct.
And it could have more reasonably been wrapped up within a short period of time.
Yes, if we hadn't gone through four judges in the district court.
Right.
To answer your question, I think that what the court is referring to there is that there is an inherent framework in the Hatch-Waxman Act. And in the Carrico case, once the 942 expired, the regular Hatch-Waxman Act comes into being and there becomes the 180-day exclusivity that the other company could get. In this case, the settlement agreement is not part of the Hatch-Waxman framework. The questions about whether Brecht will go into market or whether Brecht won't go to market are not part of that framework. And so, if this is different than waiting until the 512 expires.
You mean because under Hatch-Waxman, if this had been Hatch-Waxman triggering, they can go into market, then after 75 days, if they don't, you get to anyway, or you get to start. Is that right?
No, that wouldn't happen in that. Well, in that case...
In that, if it wasn't under settlement, but rather this was because, you know, that was the time period where they expire, that was the time period where...
The problem with that case was under the old law, and so there was no forfeiture. So you would still have to get a judgment on all of the patents. Here there's the forfeiture provision.
But it doesn't apply to a settlement.
Does not apply to a settlement. No, you have to have a judgment, final judgment.
And is that why you think there's a difference between this situation and Janssen's comments, holdings, statements, whatever they are, that delay or anticipated or potential delay by the antifirst filer is too speculative to be a real harm? Is that why you think it's different?
I think it's different for that reason. I also think it's different because Janssen entered into an agreement to agree that the patents were valid and infringed. They have not put itself in the same place as Janssen did in that case. They haven't agreed to anything.
Well, in order for the first of those two points to matter, it seems to me what you need to be saying is that unlike Carrico and Janssen, in which the delay, possible delay in launching after first opportunity for the end of filer was speculative, that that agreement makes it not speculative, or at least less speculative. So that's what I understood your first response to Judge Moore to be suggesting, correct?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, which agreement?
The settlement agreement.
The settlement agreement.
Right.
Makes it more speculative. And it's not
more speculative. I thought it would be, well, maybe I'm using the term speculative backwards. It makes it, does it make it more likely that Breath will not go to market at the first opportunity?
Yes, because we don't know what else is going on there.
Well, but we never know everything that's going
true.
On. But I'm really, that my follow-up question is, what is it about this agreement that tells us, now that we have see that agreement, the agreement that we have before us in the record in this case, that we can say, aha, that's why we can say that the likelihood that Breath will not launch as soon as it can is high enough that that's a real injury as distinguished from Carrico and Janssen. That really goes, I suppose, to the question we've asked you all to look at. But,
right.
But is there another reason why that's so?
Again, the only thing that I can point to is the fact that the whole reason that there is this DJ action, that Congress allowed a DJ action and that Congress allowed forfeiture, is because that's what was happening.
Could that be the pattern. Could I try here? It seems to me what Carrico and Janssen are saying is if you want to get declaratory judgment jurisdiction and you're during the launch period, the fact that the launch may be delayed defeats declaratory judgment, does not create declaratory judgment jurisdiction in the first place. Here, that wasn't true. When this case was commenced, you were not saying that the injury is delay in the launch. You were saying we can get this case concluded and the other case concluded in time to do something before the launch date. So once there's declaratory judgment jurisdiction in the first place, which there was here, and I think everybody agrees that there was, the fact that the launch may occur or may not occur is relevant to mootness, but not to the existence of declaratory judgment jurisdiction in the first place.
Yes, I would agree with that, Judge Dyke. So, I guess I'll conclude with my introduction. this case presents the issues that the 2003 MNA amendments were enacted to address. And as I said in response to some of your questions, the civil action to obtain patent certainty and the forfeiture provisions of the 2003 amendments to the Hatch-Waxman Act were enacted to prevent precisely what's happening here. The Hatch-Waxman scheme relies upon the early resolution of patent disputes, and settlements may resolve those disputes, but they don't necessarily get the product to the market. If Zenobian really was not going to sue us and wanted to not waste the time of the court with a declaratory judgment action, Judge Bryson is right. They could have just issued us a judgment. We could have had a stipulated judgment.
They could have stipulated to a judgment.
Yeah, they could have. Sorry. They could have stipulated to a judgment,
right.
And the judge could have signed off on it, and that would have eliminated all of this. They chose not to do that. They chose to give us a covenant not to sue when this court had already decided in Carrico that covenants not to sue were ineffective in the Hatch-Waxman case.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Leff. We will hear rebuttal from Mr. Dittman.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd first like to address the settlement agreement. There are some questions about whether there was any basis to believe that there might be a reason for a delay. The only thing the settlement agreement talks about is potentially accelerating the launch date. It doesn't say anything about delaying, or is there any a reason or incentive in the settlement agreement to provide such an incentive. And I also like to note that...
Could be,
was filed in 2008, was it?
Correct.
Do you agree there was jurisdiction at the time it was filed?
For the reasons that I discussed earlier with respect to later asserted Orange Book patents being asserted, I would submit that there was no jurisdiction from the outset.
No, what is that basis again? Explain it one more time.
The fact that there are Orange Book patents that were asserted by Sunovion in litigation that expire after the first filed breath could come to market, and thus the launch date that we're sort of we have to use as a framework under the cases discussed earlier, Carrico and Janssen, says that, you know, that's really the launch date you have to assume unless there's a basis in the record to believe otherwise. They had not pointed to anything in the record to suggest there's any reason or any possibility of a delay. I mean, here we have a situation where Breath entered into a settlement agreement in 2008. They've been preparing since then to launch on August 12th of this year. I'd also like to...
That's the two cases at once argument.
I'm sorry?
That's the two cases at once argument.
Yes. But again, it's very important what's involved in those two cases.
But apart from that argument, there was declaratory judgment jurisdiction at the outset, right?
If you reject that argument, that would be the basis. That would have been the basis for us to say there was none. But even if you look at the facts that exist today,
the answer is that putting that argument aside, there was declaratory judgment jurisdiction in the first place.
We don't agree that was our argument against that. It was the only argument that at that time in 2008. If we look at the facts as they exist today, I think Janssen's very instructive on multiple fronts here. In that case, of course, there were some different facts in that there was an actual stipulation where the subsequent filer could not come to market until at least the same date the first filer could launch because of their agreeing to be bound by a finding of infringement. There, in a separate section of the court's opinion, they addressed the argument where the subsequent filer said, very similar to today, what we're hearing from today, well, we have no guarantee they're going to launch. Maybe they'll delay. Maybe there'll be a harm. And Janssen squarely held that that is not sufficient to create jurisdiction, you know, at least without any basis in the record to conclude that's a possibility. And here, not only do we not have a basis, we don't even have any findings from the district court on this issue. So we're left here with nothing in the record, a settlement agreement that talks only about acceleration. And at that point, I did want to address that even though the agreement says that Breath can launch if another company has already launched, in that instance, 180 days is already gone. So that can't be anything that's of relevance to jurisdiction in this case because it already assumes the 180 days is gone, which is the whole point of why we're here in the first place. And I think one last point I'd like to make is that Janssen also emphasizes the importance of the 180-day exclusivity, and that here what we'd be talking about is if everything went all together for day, which we know really can't, because in 3 months they can get all these judgments that they need to trigger a potential forfeiture event, you'd be talking about merely eviscerating 180 days of the first filer just to let them in, a couple days or a week early. And in that circumstance, it's moving to admit that the incentives of the Hatch-Waxman Act have been derailed in that circumstance.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. And the case is submitted.